Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. After 16-year-old Sammy Chapman was found dead from a fentanyl poisoning he received through a drug dealer on Snapchat, his parents began lobbying for laws to help parents monitor their children's online activity. Sammy's law is now receiving bipartisan support as it makes its way through the U.S. House. To tell us more about Sammy's law, we have Washington Post technology writer Will Oremus. Last week, he wrote a new analysis titled "Sammy's Law Would Help Parents Monitor Kids Online," and it's gaining steam. Welcome back to All Sides, Will.
Thanks for having me.
So how much oversight into children's online activity would parents have through Sammy's law versus what they can do now?
What Sammy's Law does is it would require major online platforms that cater to young users to build what's called an API, application programming interface. Now, that's a very technical term. Basically, they have to create software that would allow other companies to develop monitoring tools for kids. So Snapchat, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, they wouldn't have to do the monitoring themselves under Sammy's Law. But they would have to make it possible for third-party startups to build software that would alert parents when their kids are having interactions online that meet the criteria for a certain set of harms. So if their kid is expressing thoughts of suicide, for instance, their parents would get an alert. If their kid is having an interaction with a stranger on one of these platforms that contains language that suggests there might be grooming, sexual exploitation, that kind of thing, their parents will get an alert. That's the basic idea behind this law. And it's actually a narrower version of an approach to kids' safety that Congress has been considering in various forms over the past few years.
Now, do these apps already exist to alert parents? And it's just a matter of, like, Snapchat, for example, doesn't communicate with them, or like what it's a, I don't know if it's a chicken or an egg thing.
Yeah, no, you're right. There are apps that already exist like this. And the issue is that the big platforms don't necessarily work with them or don't even necessarily allow them. And there are legitimate reasons for that. I mean, if some third-party developer comes along and says, hey, we've built this great app that's going to let everybody see people's private messages on Snapchat. Snapchat is like, hey, that violates our users' privacy. Like, when, you know, who the heck are you? Like, how do we know you have the best interests of our users in mind? What this law would do is it would allow those third-party developers to register with the Federal Trade Commission. So there would be U.S. federal government oversight of these apps to make sure that they're legitimate, to make sure that they're only monitoring for certain types of harms, that they're not spying on people for nefarious reasons, for instance. So once these apps got approval from the FTC, then a platform like Snapchat or Instagram or Roblox, which is a really popular online game with young people, would be required to allow those tools on their platforms.
Well, it seems like nothing these days is truly bipartisan, but this bill is. It has bipartisan support. So first of all, how did it do that? And do you think that that means it's likely to pass?
Yeah, there's an interesting dynamic in Washington when it comes to internet regulation, in particular to regulations that are designed to protect kids online. You're right. It is a truly bipartisan issue. There are many Democrats and many Republicans who want to get something done that is acceptable to both sides to better protect kids online. So it's not just this free-for-all. People of both parties are concerned parents, and people of both parties have lost kids to tragic harms of all kinds, including Sammy Chapman, who you mentioned at the outset. The challenge here is the trade-off is actually not so much Republicans versus Democrats. It's more about how far do you go in invading the privacy of users in order to prevent them from harm, in order to protect them from harm. And what does the First Amendment say about these kinds of laws, these kinds of efforts to protect kids? There was an effort to pass a much more sweeping law called the Kids Online Safety Act, or COSA. This actually passed the Senate on bipartisan lines last year. It got held up in the House. One of the concerns was that this law would have required big online platforms to proactively keep kids from encountering harmful material. There was concern that that would run afoul of the First Amendment. The First Amendment says the government can't pass any laws that would abridge free speech. Well, if the government is deciding what people can and can't say on these platforms, and what people can and cannot see on these platforms, that raises a potential First Amendment conflict. So Sammy's Law is kind of a fallback option, or one of the fallback options, as the House in particular looks for alternatives to this bigger Kids Online Safety Act that maybe wouldn't violate the Constitution and maybe wouldn't be as privacy invasive. That said, there are still critics who say this is invasive. This is a bill that would enable surveillance of kids, and we can't guarantee that that won't go wrong.
Yeah, there are concerns from some critics who say that sometimes kids seek refuge online in communities of friends. So specifically, an example you have in your article is there's a worry for LGBTQ children. If they live in a household that where they don't feel supported, their parents could find out things because this app is monitoring them, but then also they lose that community where they were talking to people, and were friends with them. Is that the line, the worry about the First Amendment challenge there?
I would say that's different than the First Amendment challenge, but you are right. That is another concern that people have raised about these bills and about Sammy's Law in particular. There are kids who don't feel safe at home and who find, as you said, they find refuge, they find community online. There are kids who seek out resources because they've become pregnant and they need to know what to do. They need help. There are all kinds of reasons why kids use the internet that might trigger these types of parental alerts, but maybe some people wouldn't actually want that to be triggered in these cases. And then there's also just concerns about overreach. Maybe you say it's only going to be used to monitor for these certain types of harms, but once you've enabled this pipeline of parental monitoring of what people do online, it could be exploited by bad actors. Maybe it could be used, maybe the same software could be used to monitor what adults do online. And then there's the question of how do you know that it's a kid using the device and not an adult? What kinds of privacy invasive measures might be required to differentiate between kids and adults online so that you're not surveilling adults along with the kids?
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about Sammy's Law with Washington Post reporter Will Oremus. So we mentioned Sammy's Law's name for Sammy Chapman, who was poisoned, had like poisonous fentanyl that got through a drug dealer that was found on Snapchat. So a part of the reason that this bill is bipartisan is the key words that are flagged in the bill. So I guess one of them would be dealing drugs. But then also you mentioned suicide and maybe something with firearms. Is that a part of the reason that it can be bipartisan because only certain words are flagged? Can they keep it like that?
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, I think that conservatives are often concerned that you'll end up flagging political speech that they see as valid, and that they'll end up being sort of censored or silenced because those words will trigger alerts or trigger moderation or censorship. People on the left are often concerned that language around reproductive health or language around LGBTQ plus issues will trigger alerts improperly. So the authors of this bill did craft it to make sure that none of those things are causes for triggering an alert. The causes are things that basically everybody can agree are bad for kids, and that are also illegal for kids.
But where's the line? Because can a parent add more words, or would it stick to just those words, right?
Well, right. I mean, if and that those are the types of concerns that critics raise. They say, look, these laws can have the best of intentions, but you just don't know how they'll play out in the real world. But if you look at the letter of the law, it does. There is that safeguard where the apps have to be verified by the Federal Trade Commission. And so there's this audit that happens at the federal level to make sure the apps are doing what they say they do. We are also living in a time when the Federal Trade Commission is less bipartisan than it used to be. Earlier in his term, President Trump fired the two Democratic members of what used to be a bipartisan commission. So there are now only Republicans on it. That has some legal experts believe that has effectively ended the independence of this commission, and it's now a political body instead of an independent body that may erode the trust that one party or the other has in a commission like this.
In the reporting that you've done on different social media apps, different technology that parents use to try to figure out what's going on, have you found the line? Where is the line between privacy and a parent's right to know? What rights do parents have?
It's a great question. I mean, under the law, parents do have, when a parent wants to know what their kid is doing online, that is legal. They can do that. But again, there are the unintended consequences where people worry that adults will have their privacy compromised. People worry that every internet user will have to have their privacy compromised just to figure out who's an adult, who's a kid. I mean, this is one of the fundamental things about the internet. There's that famous old New Yorker cartoon about on the internet, you have a dog sitting in front of a monitor, and it says, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." Well, on the internet, nobody knows if you're a kid or a grown-up. And all these laws that are intended to protect kids would probably be unconstitutional if they were applied to adults. And so this includes, by the way, we haven't mentioned this yet, but there's a series of laws in US states, bills in Congress, and laws in other countries, including the UK, that are intended to keep minors off of adult websites. Now, again, the problem is how do you know who's a minor and who's an adult? My colleague at the Washington Post, Drew Harwell, came out with a story over this weekend that said in the United Kingdom, where they've just enacted this Online Safety Act, which is somewhat similar to the bills that are being considered in the US, what happened when they tried to bar minors from adult websites is that all the law-abiding adult websites that complied with this law saw their traffic drop off. And they were hurt by it because even adults don't want to go to the site now if you have to prove who you are, right? Like nobody wants to show an ID card or, upload their identity to go to an adult website. But all these shady adult websites from other countries that are based, their corporation is based in, offshore, they're not obeying the law. Their traffic has soared. And so what's happening is that people are just finding ways to get around the law. The other thing that has soared is the usage of VPNs or virtual private networks. These are technological tools that mask who you are, where you're coming from when you're online. So you can make it look to a website like you're actually coming from Canada or coming from Barbados or coming from Papua New Guinea, when in fact you're coming from the UK and you can get around laws like this. They've seen a huge boom in traffic. So people just, people tend to find ways around it. And it's the people who obey the law and follow the law who end up sometimes suffering.
The idea that social media companies, like, how are they replying to something like Sammy's Law? Because I would think that a company like even Snapchat, Facebook, Meta, would want kids to be safe. They don't want something like with what happened to Sammy Chapman to happen. They don't want you to find a drug dealer that has poison through their app. So how do they decide where safety and the freedom of their app, where's the line for them?
Yeah, that is a big issue. I mean, you're right. None of these online platforms that I know of want kids to come to harm on their site. The question is, what measures are they willing to accept to avoid that? One of the big proposals over the years has been the idea of revoking this law called Section 230. This has been a foundational law for the internet companies because what it says is that if you're an online platform and somebody puts illegal stuff on your site, you can't be sued just for having hosted that, right? You can't be treated like you were the person who posted it just because you're Facebook and a user posted something that's illegal. There have been calls to overturn that law over the years, and the tech companies have vociferously opposed that. They do not want to be going to court every time somebody says something that's potentially illegal on their platforms because they have hundreds of millions, maybe billions of users, it would put them out of business, right? But at least in theory, that's their argument. Now, with Sammy's Law, the tech companies mostly have not weighed in on this yet, and that's because it has not seriously been considered by Congress yet. My article was about how it may get its chance this term in the coming months in the House as the House looks for alternatives to these broader laws like the Kids Online Safety Act. But we do not know what the tech companies will say yet. Now, when I talked to Samuel Chapman, the father of Sammy, he said his hope is that the tech companies will not oppose this one because it doesn't really require much from them. It doesn't expose them to new lawsuits the way some of these other solutions would. That remains to be seen. There is also a really fascinating battle going on right now between some of the tech companies as to who should be responsible for figuring out who's a minor and who's an adult online. So you have Apple and Google who are backing these laws that would make the individual apps like Facebook and Snapchat and Roblox responsible for making sure they're not serving harmful content to minors. At the same time, you've got these app makers, you've got Facebook in particular, lobbying for laws that would make Google and Apple responsible for figuring out who's a kid at the time that they buy the iPhone or the Android phone. And so there are state laws that in both directions, you've got a big lobbying fight between the tech companies over who should be responsible for this.
Yeah, there's also a lot of confusing things because whenever I tried to get my son a game on his iPad that he really wanted, I had to like lie and say he was 10 and not 8 because he couldn't play, right? Because it's just, right? And I'm the adult doing that because, but the game was harmless, right? And I don't know why it was for 10-year-olds. Maybe it's the ads. I have no idea. But it made me pause because I'm like, wait, how old are you? What is this? What is happening? It's hard to really keep up with it all.
It is. And so what privacy advocates fear is that in all the good intentions to protect kids online, we end up fundamentally changing the internet where you really can't be anonymous anymore. And some people may say, hey, great, that's, anonymity enables all these bad things. But if we had an internet where you can't be anonymous anymore, and that's what authoritarian countries want, because then there's no freedom online. There's no freedom in anonymity. There's no safe harbor for dissidents. There's no way for people to speak out against a regime online. So if you want to take the doomsday scenario there, we end up with an internet where you just can't be anonymous anymore, and it's no longer this force for free speech that it once was. All the people who are advocating for the laws say, look, that's taking it too far. We're trying to carefully craft these laws to come up with common sense solutions to better protect kids from this, scary wild west of harms. And we're going to keep working until we find something that does accord with the First Amendment and that does preserve the privacy of adults online.
Well, we've been talking about Sammy's Law, which would allow parents to track kids' activity on social media, and we've been talking with Washington Post tech reporter Will Oremus. Will, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks as always, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about a possible future without handwriting. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Chromebooks, iPads, and other devices have been integrated into most school systems. Naturally, students are writing less by hand. But will they eventually stop writing with pencil and pen and paper altogether? Should schools continue to teach handwriting forever? And what about teaching cursive handwriting? Robert Wiley is an assistant professor for psychology at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, where he specializes in written language. Welcome to All Sides, Robert.
Hello, happy to be here today.
So your research includes discovering how the brain processes written information. So can you give us a rundown? What happens in the brain when we're writing something by hand versus typing it?
Well, so the part of this, so that distinction has to do mostly with the motor output, right? So there's different skills used to manipulate a pen or a pencil compared to a keyboard. But the critical difference that we'll probably talk about is that with handwriting, you're having to actually make the shapes of those letters. Whereas when you're typing, you're really just kind of pecking, right? So the actual motion you're using is much simpler. And it's more about the spatial layout, knowing where that key is, not really about what the shape of the letter is that you're trying to produce.
Well, this topic came to our attention because we saw a piece from Wired, and the piece was called The End of Handwriting. The subtitle was, "For years, smartphones and computers have threatened to erase writing by hand. Would that be so bad?" So it asked the question. So that's my question to you. Would it be so bad to lose handwriting?
There's a lot of different aspects, I think, to this question. There's different things that could potentially be lost. And sort of the answer for whether or not that matters depends on the type of thing you're talking about. So sometimes people wonder about sort of connection to our history, you know, the documents that, of course, the, you know, up until only the last few decades, written documents were by hand, mm-hmm. right? We communicated through mail by handwriting for the most part. But that sort of aspect is different from the questions about how it affects learning, whether that's in children or adults, when you're first trying to learn written language, which has nothing to do with, you know, the historicity of it, and everything to do with how the brain develops and grows as you try to learn to read, is really the ultimate question here.
Do you remember more when you write it by hand versus, I guess, typing?
Generally, yes. So some of this question first came up actually in the context of note-taking, where people were wondering, noticing, for example, college students are now taking all their notes on laptops. They're not writing them by hand anymore. And there were questions about whether or not that matters. Is the quality of the notes worse? And is it, like all science, is sort of a complicated answer, where the answer is generally yes, the notes are worse when they're typed, but it's not necessarily the case that that will be true. Writing by hand usually causes you to be more reflective. You have to take a little bit more time. You have to choose what you're going to take notes about. Whereas if you're typing, you can kind of try to verbatim quickly write down everything you're hearing, which means you're not really thinking about what you're hearing right now. You're not processing it to the same degree. So you can be taught to take typed notes that are of the same quality, but people's natural inclination is maybe not to be so thoughtful when they're typing notes.
So you would be an advocate of keeping handwriting in schools. But what about the idea of teaching typing? There used to be tons of classes where everyone thought you had to put your hands on the keyboard in a certain way, and that was the best way to do it. Those seem to have fallen by the wayside, too. So where should our focus be? Should we be focusing on pretty handwriting, any handwriting in general, good typing? Where does our brain need to go here?
I think that the point, and why if I were to advocate for anything, I would say that the importance of handwriting, it's not about the handwriting itself. So like, it's not about penmanship, for example. This really doesn't come into the equation. There's a difference in handwriting in terms of how you are connecting. So for example, if you're writing to dictation, then you're hearing what someone says, while also using your body to produce that written language. And typically you also then look at what you're writing. So you're hearing something, you're producing something with your hand, and you're seeing something all at the same time. And so you've associated with those in your mind. What you're hearing, what it means, what you're seeing, what you're doing with your body, it's all connected. It reinforces itself. The typing experience isn't rich in that same way, because what you're producing, moving your fingers around typing, doesn't really have much to do with what you're seeing. So, you know, if you're typing an A versus typing an S, the actual motion is almost the same, right? There's barely any difference between typing an A and an S, but writing an A versus writing an S is a very different set of motions. And it's not arbitrary. The motions you're going through relate back to the actual shapes that you're seeing. And so there's this sort of benefit from handwriting. It's not necessary. In fact, I want to point out that people have been able to learn to read who cannot write for any number of reasons, right? Whether they've developed that way, or say you have a stroke and you can no longer write. So it's not that writing is necessary for learning to read, but that sort of reinforcement of connecting what you're doing with your body, with what you're seeing, with what you're hearing, it proves to be advantageous. So people, they learn a little bit more quickly. Their memory of what they're doing is a little bit stronger by having that experience.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the future of handwriting in schools with Assistant Professor of Psychology Robert Wiley. What about writing with a stylus if you have an iPad and an Apple Pencil? Is that the same as writing pencil on paper?
There are some subtle differences because the what's called the haptic feedback, so sort of the sensation you're getting, is different. If you've done it, you know that you can tell it's not, paper, it's not graphite on paper, it feels different. But mostly what I'm talking about here, it even goes so far as to say it might not even be about the hand. So if we say wrote in the sand with our toes, that might be just as beneficial because you're still using your body to make the shapes of the letters. Maybe if you've, if you formed the letters out of Play-Doh or something like that, even that might be beneficial. The point is more that you're actually creating the shapes of the letters yourselves, and you're not really doing that when you're typing.
What about cursive handwriting? Because that is definitely falling off. Schools, the school my kids go to, they do not require you to learn cursive. So the very first time my daughter ever had to sign her name, she looked at me like I had three heads. She was like, "What does that even mean?"
Yes.
But do we need cursive, or are you just trying to say, let's at least still write, keep handwriting alive, forget cursive?
The cursive, I think, relates more to the first question of sort of the connection to history and previous documents. There's not strong evidence that practice with handwriting cursive as opposed to practice with writing print letters makes a difference for your ability to learn, your memory, anything like that. There are some differences in how they're perceived. The thing that's most clearly lost if you don't practice handwriting is the ability to read cursive. I'm sorry, to not practice cursive. It's not so specific in itself to the type of like the font that you're using. Maybe not so consequential, as long as again you're producing those shapes with your body.
So my kids will never be able to read a letter from my grandmother because it's all in cursive and they'll have no idea what those letters are, right?
They won't. Many of them look, I mean, they do look very different. And, if you do know cursive, if you were brought up learning it, it's easy to forget that because it's so internalized. It's automatic. So you can look at a cursive G and you just like, of course that's a G. But if you didn't know, if you put them side by side, it's not at all obvious that a cursive G is the same as a print G. They don't really look alike in the uppercase anyway. So yes, you won't really recognize it if you're not producing it and seeing it all the time.
There is a movement to bring back cursive. I mean, I've seen pieces of legislation that want that. What would you advocate for schools to teach cursive?
It's only the only possible downside is that there are only so many hours in the day, which I think is part of why these debates sort of started, is that schools are, only open so many hours, and there are so many demands on teachers and students for what to teach, what to learn, that you have to sort of weigh the costs and the benefits. There aren't really costs to cursive other than the trade-off of the time you're spending. Are the benefits worth it? That's, it's a decision for each school district to make for itself, I think.
The idea of teaching handwriting in a digital age, I would think that handwriting would still be a good focus in maybe K1 and 2, but then computers get used more and more as we head into the upper elementary grades. But is handwriting something you have to practice? Do you lose it? The same way I probably don't remember how to make a cursive Q because I would never write the letter Q. Right? Do you have to practice handwriting to do it?
Actually, yes, it's there's this really interesting concept that it actually first came from China. This term is called character amnesia, but we also have some evidence of this in our alphabet too. The idea is that you may it's sort of the almost the reverse of what you said, where you might not you forget how to produce a letter that you might recognize. So when you see it, you recognize it, but then if you went to try to write it, you might realize, oh gosh, I don't actually know how to write that anymore. So they found that in China for some similar reasons having to do with the shift to digital technology from handwriting, where there are these characters where people they can read them, but they realize they can't write them. And there's some similar things that we've found in our alphabet where certain letters, like the lowercase g, which has there's two different shapes for that g, if you can kind of have in your head what I'm talking about. Like in Google, their lowercase g is different than the g that would you would normally think of. So people, when they read them, they recognize them, but they actually are terrible at trying to write that alternative style of a g, even though they see it all the time. So there is a bit of a use it or lose it situation here.
Okay, so cursive aside, regular handwriting, like the way that we print letters, can we lose that? Or do we need to keep up with it past, first grade?
I think in the extreme, you could lose the ability. If you were literally never ever writing it, you might forget sort of the conventions. What is most likely is that you'll probably be much slower, right? It'll be a more effortful process for you. I frankly suspect people already feel that somewhat because they're not writing on a daily basis. Some people, I believe, are not even writing on a weekly basis by hand. And so that process of writing is probably more effortful than it would otherwise be if they were keeping it up more.
I can imagine also if you had to write an essay out instead of typing it and you weren't used to it, your hand would hurt afterward, right? If you're out of practice.
Absolutely. With the changes with AI that are coming, they're here, I should say, not coming, but are here. There's been some talk of going back to doing, having students do more assignments on paper because of questions of cheating. But I think there's a serious question to ask whether that's going to be so easy for them to do, writing and having a 2-hour class where you have to sit and write an essay in what's called a blue book, if you were familiar with these old
I
blue books.
remember the blue books and it makes my hand ache thinking about it.
Yes,
Yes.
yes. So imagine that you have never sat and written for that long in your life. It might be quite a challenge for people, but I think we're about to find out. We're getting, yeah.
Yeah, I did read in this article from Wired about the end of handwriting is a way to combat AI is some professors, rather than giving you the assignment and letting you type it at home, they are thinking about making students sit in the classroom for an hour and a half and write about the history of Roman architecture and just to see if they actually know it, rather than asking AI to explain it.
Yes, that's right. So there might be a bit of a challenge for them doing that by hand, just from the lack of experience with ever having done something like that by hand.
And then there'll be the experience of the teacher trying to read it.
A second issue here, that's right. The penmanship has probably declined, so they may also have it cut out for them now to try to interpret what the students have written. Yeah.
So do you the title for the Wired article that we're referring to for this segment is The End of Handwriting, and that digital work will take over written work. Do you think that is true someday? I'm not talking in the next 10 years, but I'm talking maybe 50, 100 years.
Well, you actually raised something that kind of argues against that possibility, which is that our technology doesn't mean we can't write anymore. We can have a stylus, right? We can still be writing digitally. We do have that technology. So one possibility is that that could become more of the norm, where more of us have a stylus to be doing a digital writing. That's a possibility. There's also the fact that, sometimes the power goes out. Right? Sometimes the internet goes down. And to think that you could put yourself in a situation where you're going to say, too bad, so sad, I simply can't communicate now by writing, it's kind of wild to think that. So I don't know that that extreme case will ever come true. But I think what has already come true is it's that, people are learning maybe a little bit slower than they would. They maybe have a little bit weaker memory than they would have otherwise. And that might seem like a small thing, but these. Consequences might accumulate and have more of an impact, than you might otherwise realize.
So, just as a final question, as we keep adapting to new technology, what would you say to, a teacher of like a middle schooler or high schooler where more and more things are being done on the computer? Would you encourage them to still have students write by hand from time to time?
I think that having a range of different experiences is what's going to be most beneficial because the way the mind works is we form these associations. So the more ways you can work with written language, like I said, I mean, make the letters out of Play-Doh, play with blocks, any different type of experience, it's going to enrichen that. So yeah, I would encourage even in college, some of the studies I've done are with old include older adults. So this is not something that's only for children first learning. You're going to continue to have some sort of benefits from enriching your experience. And that might mean doing a little, maybe it might even mean doing a little bit of cursive every now and then, just for the sake of that enriching of the experience.
Or at least learn the cursive letters of your own name. So whenever your mom asks you to sign a check, you know what to do.
At the very
At
least,
the
that's
very
what,
least, yes.
yeah.
We've been talking about the past and future of handwriting with Robert Wiley, an assistant professor for psychology at UNC Greensboro. He specializes in written language. Thank you so much for your time, Robert.
Thank you very much.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how AAA is warning us to stay alert on the road. Driver assistance systems are not as reliable as we think. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. AAA released new information showing the true reliability of active driver assistance systems. Russell Hawley is the Director of Commerce Content at CNET, and he's here to share more information with us. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So although cruise control and lane assistance are helpful tools, AAA is warning us to stay alert on the road. What were the findings of this new study when they looked at driver assistance systems?
Yeah, so when AAA did this study, they were just about as inclusive as they could for what falls under that umbrella of driver assistance. So, you know, you may think about what Tesla calls full self-drive, or what Subaru calls, I direct and being able to use all of these things that like tug the wheel slightly to keep you in a lane versus something that presents itself as being, you know, kind of capable of driving on your behalf. And each one of those, the systems, anytime there was something like a car cutting you off in traffic, through simulations that they had done, what they call notable events, where these systems in many cases failed to engage in a way that actually protected the driver, from that accident.
Yeah, I mean, I can attest. I have a Subaru with EyeSight, and it does work sometimes, but other times it's alerting me left and right that I'm leaving the lane when I'm not like so I don't know how reliable are these systems. Are they just supposed to be a secondary thing as opposed to paying attention when you're driving?
I think the conclusion that AAA drives gets to here is very similar to one that I had gained from my own personal experience with a lot of these different vehicles, is that they can be quite useful systems, as long as you are still the active driver. Mm-hmm. So both hands on the wheel, which Subaru in particular is really great at reminding you of. Mm-hmm. If you've let go of the wheel for a second, it knows right away, especially in newer versions of EyeSight, and will flash a warning on the screen that says, please put both hands on the wheel. I have found, and AAA, corroborates this, that when it comes to things like being able to quickly apply brakes, in easy to predict environments, like someone in front of you has slammed on the brakes, mm-hmm. Then that is, something that these systems can handle quite well. But in things where, you're at a bend in the road, or a vehicle has, cut you off, or, there was a sudden merge ahead of you or something like that, these systems are frequently, just not suited to, completely take over for the driver.
Did AAA also look at self-driving cars, or even cars like that have no human driving?
No, this is very specifically for driving assistance. Mm-hmm. And it's important to keep in mind that that is still very much, in a legal sense, what things like Tesla full self-drive is considered. It is an assistive driving assistant. It does not meet the threshold for intelligent self-driving in the same way that like Waymo cars are, or Tesla's, you know, if it ever comes out, their robo-taxi service, where it's, you know, supposed to be, you know, completely driverless. Those systems are, they meet a completely different classification that has a completely different set of legal standards that changes from state to state as far as what constitutes, you know, fully autonomous driving. So this is very specifically aimed at driving assistance vehicles, you know, from a variety of capability standpoints.
So bottom line is AAA wants you to embrace these assistive technologies, but still pay attention.
Not only is that the case, but because of findings like this, it helps make the legal case for whether or not you as the driver are at fault if you fail to have your hands on the wheel when an accident occurs that you could be seen as the cause of.
Yeah, I guess if I don't, that's a whole nother legal thing we could get into. It's probably a whole nother show of whether they can like get the record of the car to say whether the car warned you to put your hands on the wheel or not.
That's exactly right. And there have been cases, you know, I am certainly not going to speak as a lawyer here, but there have been cases in the last 5 years where exactly that argument has been made. And in many cases, the driver of the vehicle that was found to be at fault was not able to use, you know, the fact that they had driving assistance as a reasonable argument.
Right. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Tech Tuesday. We're talking about some recent tech news with CNET Director of Commerce Content, Russell Hawley. I wanted to move on to Taco Bell. It's approaching lunchtime. We can all get hungry. But Taco Bell took 2 million orders with their AI ordering system, but they have decided to shut it down and are switching back to a human ordering system. Why are they switching back?
In a very short sentence, because it just didn't work, and it didn't work in so many hilariously terrible ways that there really is just no other option than to start over from scratch. Taco Bell deployed this system last year, and they set it up in such a way that there was an AI that was, you know, transcribing your speech and assembling the order and then passing it over to someone who would then construct that order. But the entire time that order was being recorded by an AI, there was still a human being listening. So human interference could happen in the event that the order just got wildly out of control and you know, something was terribly wrong, so that you didn't, you know, end up ordering, you know, 50 tacos and then get to the counter and you know, be surprised by the order. But there were, even with human interference, there were some really interesting failure points here that was documented, you know, in a couple of different places, one of which was a customer. There is a video of a customer pulling up to a Taco Bell and just ordering as though they were ordering from the McDonald's menu, using the proper names of you know, items from McDonald's. And Taco Bell started taking the order down as though it was a McDonald's ordering system, and then attempting to pass that over to the person working there.
Yeah, Taco Bell is not going to have a Big Mac, so it shouldn't be able to recognize that, right? Yeah.
That's exactly right. You know, there were reminders posted on a regular basis that raising your voice to the AI system did not actually improve the quality of the order, and that there was, in fact, a person listening because it would get it wrong so often.
Yeah.
That, you know, it was common to believe that raising your voice would actually cause this to work better.
The headline of the CNET story about this says 18 thousands of cups of water later, this is not working. What does that refer to?
Yes, there are two different videos. Once these AI failures started going out, there was, you know, obviously folks who thought that they could become TikTok famous by making the orders as absurd as possible. And one of which was going through the drive-thru and placing an order for 18,000 cups of water.
The AI took the order. It said, okay.
The AI took the order and said, yep, pull around to the next window and everything will be just fine. This is something where, you know, again, the human listening could, you know, could obviously reject that order and not attempt to make that charge. But you know, this is, you know, the direction that several restaurants have attempted across the U.S. With not failure rates that are not quite as high as what Taco Bell has seen, at least not what they have reported, but very few cases where someone has completed one of these orders and felt like this was an improved experience versus having a person there to take your order.
Here in Columbus, where Wendy's is headquartered here. And so we, when Wendy's was one of the first to have AI at their drive-thru, and obviously Columbus is where they beta tested it because this is where they're headquartered. And I have to say, it's gotten better. We order Wendy's from time to time, and months ago it got my order wrong, or it was confusing, or I would feel the need to raise my voice, you know. But I think it's gotten better. Have you seen that? Do some fast food places have some success?
Sure. I mean, there are absolutely places where the experience has improved over time, and this is something that customer satisfaction surveys have bore out, not just for Wendy's, but a few kind of regional chains as well. That have deployed similar technologies. I think it just depends on the quality of the service that the company has engaged to begin with, and being able to let the system run long enough to learn from things like repeat orders. And Wendy's menu is one of those things that is at least its descriptions are fairly unique. And so it's easy to not confuse those orders for something else. There are very few other places that have something that sound like Baconator, for example, so something like that. We call them AI, but the original name for a lot of these technologies was machine learning. So they were designed to learn and improve over time, aside, from systems that are built, with a global set of tools like it seems the one Taco Bell was using, instead of very narrowly focused on Wendy's menu.
Yeah, well, and I also have to say that it's probably a little bit of human learning too, because my kids like it plain, they don't want ketchup or anything, like they just want cheese. And so I learned the right words to say, because if I try to say remove all of this, the thing would get confused. But if I just said plain, then it would knew what I meant. And that's a human learning where I learned how to order.
I was about to say, does that mean Wendy's is training you versus the other way around?
That's what I felt like, because then they got it right once I started using the word plain instead of saying the phrase with nothing on it. Is that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I guess my final question about this part is, companies like Taco Bell have spent a lot of money on these systems. I mean, making an AI system can't be cheap. So are they really going to just abandon the whole thing?
I think in many cases, these are third-party companies that have come in to partner with groups like Wendy's and Taco Bell. I'm certainly not going to speak for every company there, but in many cases, it's a third party that has come in that they are licensing technology from. So for Taco Bell, it could be as simple as, we had a 6-month contract or however long for this company and it didn't work out, so we're just terminating that contract and we'll try something else later. Having now seen, varying results from other companies, but also, given the sort of general economic instability, it may not be, a terrible surprise to see some of these companies finding ways to cut back on costs. And right now, AI is very much a cost.
All right. And our final topic today, Russell, is that Spotify has a new feature that the company says users have been asking for. It's in-app messaging, and it will allow friends to share music recommendations. Spotify did not allow messaging or sharing. This is new.
Well, Spotify has had an external sharing function for a while now, where if you have a playlist or, a favorite song or something like that, that you can share a link to that thing. And you can send it to, either a text message or across, WhatsApp or something like that. And if the other person has Spotify, then they can, engage that service. And if they don't have Spotify, then it would launch a web browser that would allow you to see the songs that were available and play, either with ads or some other or variation of the technology. But you don't always get the message exactly the way that Spotify intends. Sending a message that is a complicated link introduces several ways for that to fail. And so that is the biggest reason that subscribers have asked for the ability to send directly to other Spotify subscribers, because, you're already in the app, you already know how that's going to function. Very much like green bubbles versus blue bubbles on iPhones, if you're not a Spotify member, chances are, you're just kind of out of the group socially to begin with, for a lot of those kinds of subscribers. So being able to send a playlist, kind of at will is something that a lot of music fans, just regardless of platforms, really enjoy. And this effort is so Spotify, can make that easier for people to do.
Is it just for playlists, or can we send messages like where I can say, do you like this song, or have you heard this, like, and they can reply?
This is a full messaging service. You can have entire conversations. This is not just for links. And this benefits, you know, Spotify by keeping people in the app and keeping them, you know, kind of engaged with the service, which means more opportunities to deliver things like advertisements and you know, making sure that someone is continuously listening versus you know, using it when they remember to use it is something that benefits Spotify quite a bit.
Is Spotify going to turn into a social media app now? They're going to let you add pictures and all kinds of other stuff?
That's a great question. So far, pictures are not something that is included in the messaging service as we have gone to test it. However, you know, I suspect that if this benefits Spotify in a way that it means people are just constantly using the app, it could theoretically turn into a tiny social network.
This is giving me, with the idea of music and words and then pictures, this is giving me MySpace vibes. I don't know.
All roads lead back to MySpace. Tom had it figured out way before the rest of us.
Will it be free for Spotify? Do you have to be a member, a subscriber?
Messages available to free and premium members. However, it is age gated to people who are 16 and up. So if you are under age 16, or you have an account that has not verified that you are an adult in one form or another by adding a credit card or something like that, the messages will not be available to you at this time.
I want to say thank you to Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Thanks, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And if you missed any part of today's show, listen at our website, wosu.org/allsides. Subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform, and you can also listen on the free WOSU mobile app. Thanks to senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, student producers Iza Huck and Colin Simpson, video production by The Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.